Regards to parents and parents who represent the appellant across the county, Donaldson & Johnson. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for the district court committed 4 errors in this case, each independently or contributing to the guilty verdict, and each independently warranting reversal. The first was the failure to suppress evidence from the unlawful search of Mr. Johnson's cell phone. The second was the failure to suppress evidence from the unlawful search of Ms. McAlpine's home at 905 Missouri Street. The third was the improper admission of testimonial hearsay in violation of the Confrontation Clause. And the fourth was the improper admission of ballistics expert testimony. I want to start first with cell phone search orders. The Supreme Court's decision in Riley v. California made clear that cell phones are differ both in a qualitative and quantitative sense from other objects, and individual privacy interests in cell phones are therefore much greater than any other objects, and even the home.
I know you want to start on this issue, but it's sort of interrelated with the search of the home, and that was the district court's factual finding with regard to consent, both as to the search of the home and asking the officers to look at his cell phone so that they could confirm that he had not, in fact, had any communication with his
officer. Yeah, I'll address that. I think the district court found that the consent that Mr. Nelson gave Lieutenant Riccone, who was the lieutenant at the scene, was limited at the scene to his outgoing call logs, right? Because the situation there was the police showed up in response to what turned out to be a phony or a false 911 report. And so there, the consent was limited to the call logs. Now, there's the issue of what happened later at the police station. And again, if you look at the record, our position is that whatever consent Mr. Johnson gave to the officers there was also limited to any communications between him and his ex-girlfriend. I think there's limited consent is well recognized, and so our position is that notwithstanding that, that consent did not open the door, absent another exception, for the police to then undertake a warrantless search of the rest of the contents of the cell phone.
District's factual finding establishing consent for the search of the home, which, as I understand it, was based on an express adverse credibility determination, just to the testimony of the current girlfriend or aunt or whatever we're calling her,
correct,
and crediting the testimony of the San Francisco police officer.
So I think that our argument is that notwithstanding that adverse credibility finding, all the other undisputed facts in the record make it such that the circumstances of the encounter were such that any consent that Ms. McAlpine gave to Officer Wise could not be voluntary under Umber versus North Carolina, in this case, his progeny.
But doesn't that beg the question as to whether or not her testimony was believable in the face of the express findings by Judge Breyer, or was it Judge Anderson?
Judge Anderson.
The suppression hearing, he made a mixed question of law and fact that the consent was freely and voluntarily given.
So I think one really important fact that this court cannot overlook, and I think the district court did overlook, was in crediting all of the officers who testified, including Officer Wise. And his testimony is probably the most important because he was the one who made contact with Ms. McAlpine. Officer Wise testified at the suppression hearing that he handcuffed Mr. Johnson outside the home in the presence of Ms. McAlpine, and said he was doing so because he was on parole. The district court did not, in crediting the officer testimony, it completely neglected that undisputed fact. And it's our position that regardless of whether the fact that Officer Wise asked Ms. McAlpine for her permission to search the home thereafter, any consent she gave thereafter was followed and expressed assertion by the police of their authority to be able to search the home without a warrant.
Make sure I understand your argument. I thought her testimony was that she never saw him in handcuffs. So, and if that's true, then why did the district court err in relying on her testimony, at least to the extent that it found she consented, given the testimony of Officer Wise?
it was error to render, make an adverse credibility finding as to this McDowell point, but then pluck the one piece that is contradicted by Officer Wise's testimony.
You're a trial lawyer. We're all familiar with the situation where the jury is permitted to credit all of the testimony of a witness, none of the testimony, or some of the testimony. Isn't that the situation that we have here? We have to rely on the trier of fact to sort of pick and choose, given all the other evidence in the case, what the fact finder says actually happened.
I think, yes and no, I think putting that aside, all the other circumstances of the search really cast doubt on whether any consent she gave could have been voluntary. The police arrived on scene. There were six officers who immediately were there, 12 officers ultimately at the scene of what is a very small apartment in the Patrol Projects. I've been there myself, it's maybe 200 square feet. The circumstances.
It's in an apartment building, though, right?
It's in a complex where every apartment is.
It's in a public housing project, so I can't fault the police for reconnaissance in force in response to this kind of a call.
Agreed, Your Honor, but at the same time, I think that then changes the circumstances of the encounter and makes it more likely to be coercive.
But isn't the question one of timing? In other words, if the district court found that the consent was given before all these other officers arrived and thought they were conducting a parole search, at that point it's legally irrelevant, is it not, as to whether some of the officers thought they were conducting a parole search, other officers thought they were conducting a consent search. The consent is valid, it's valid, right?
I think you're right, the timing is critical. But I think the timing and the facts in this case are such that even before that first encounter, every officer who made first contact before Officer Wise asked for consent believed they were conducting a parole search. They went there.
Well, they transmitted that to Ms. McAllen.
Ms. McAllen?
Tell her that they were doing a parole search.
I think that's a question. That I think the closest that we have in the record is where Officer Wise testified that he handcuffed Mr. Dawson in front of Ms. McAllen and said he was doing so because he was in parole.
What do we do with that? I think the district court also relied, or maybe I'm inferring this, that due to the nature of the call, the attempted suicide with a gun, that the officers would have had an independent community caretaking function role to enter the apartment to make sure that someone was not actually inside and to secure any weapon that might be to have been used to enter the suicide. Did the court consider that?
Yes, but I think the factual circumstances in this case are such that when the police arrived at 905 Missouri, it was almost immediately clear to them that any exigency or emergency that was reported by the 911 call turned out to be false. And so in some sense, the exigency was extinguished. It doesn't matter of timing.
But assuming that there was no other victim besides Mr. Johnson, right?
That's correct.
But the officers are responding to an attempted suicide. And according to the ex-girlfriend, it was Johnson who was the one who was trying to kill himself.
Right.
And then when the officers arrived, Johnson's standing, I guess, on the balcony, and it's pretty clear. And I guess the officer recognizes him, so he knows if Johnson's trying to kill himself, he has not succeeded.
Right. I think the record is clear that the officers themselves realized that any potential emergency was extinguished by the time they showed up because they made contact.
That's what I'm challenging with my question. I'm not so sure if the nature of the call suggests the presence of a weapon. At that point, no weapon had been secured. And I think a reasonable officer under those circumstances would, A, want to clear the premises to make sure there was not, in fact, someone injured inside, and B, located and secure a weapon if there was. Your answer, I think, assumes that once you saw Mr. Johnson standing on the balcony, then it wasn't an attempted suicide call because that had disappeared with Mr. Johnson's
healthy
appearance.
Your Honor, my answer is slightly different than that. I think the answer is that in the factual scenario in this case, which is undisputed, even by the testimony of officers, there is the space and time in which they arrived at the scene. They made contact with Ms. McAlpine. They made contact with Mr. Johnson at the upstairs window. He came downstairs, and all the officers at the scene recognized, in their judgment at the scene at the time, that any danger, immediate danger, had been extinguished. The two people who were in the house were already outside. So I think in that circumstance, it's a little different from saying the officers on the scene, as a matter of policy, would automatically feel like they need to get into the house and kind of clear it out.
I didn't mean to hang you up on this.
No.
You wanted to talk about the other two issues.
Yeah, I think I want to go back to the cell phone search. But I think this case is, this court's precedence in the United States versus Bora applied Riley to probation searches as well. And so in light of Riley and Bora, I think it establishes that warrantless searches of a parolee cell phone are also unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment.
Well, why would that be, given the Supreme Court's decision in Sampson, that basically imposed warrantless search conditions on parole? Is your argument that a cell phone is entitled to a higher level of Fourth Amendment protection than a residence?
Yes, and actually the Supreme Court
person.
The Supreme Court recognized that in Riley. Our argument is that
that there are differing degrees of protection, or isn't it still driven by the question of whether or not the search is reasonable under those circumstances?
It is still a reasonable analysis, but the Supreme Court in Riley made really clear that searches of cell phones have to be looked at unique and separate apart from searches of any other possessions or even the home.
But is it a different Fourth Amendment standard? I think is what it really is.
I think our argument is that the Supreme Court's decision in Riley recognized that privacy interests in cell phones are higher than protection of the home and other objects. So on that one end of the spectrum, privacy interests in cell phones are higher. And that outweighs any marginal difference.
Of cell phones are higher because there's a great deal of information.
Correct.
Suppose that the information was not held on a cell phone, but about your filing cabinets.
Well, the Supreme Court, to talk about that precise situation, is it's the way you access the data on a cell phone. It's the immediacy and the amount of data that you can access. And the way cell phones are developing in the future, it's not just an individual's data. It's a lot of data that even for a parolee, the police would otherwise need a warrant to access in a physical
vehicle. Can you give me a circumstance where a cell phone can be searched without a warrant?
I think the point is, without a warrant, the extreme circumstances exception is one kind of escape valve that the police can still use after Riley to search. And I think that is a good example of where the great affordables that the government sees with dispensing with the warrant requirement for parolee cell phones isn't really that true, right? Because to the extent there is an emergency or an extreme circumstance,
the parolee's filing system could be searched by a Samsung, but not a cell phone.
Right, but there are other examples where, for example, a parolee's bank records, or if a parolee had a safe deposit box at a bank, or medical records in a doctor's office, you can access that through a phone without a warrant under Samsung, if that's what the government's position is. With the cell phone, you can access that, whereas the police would need a warrant to get the information.
Did Riley have anything to do with the parolee?
No, it didn't. That's correct. But the Ninth Circuit in 2016, in a case called the United States versus Laura, applied Riley's reasoning to the searches of probationers. Samson said that they are different. Our argument.
Continuum, I guess.
That's correct. But our argument is that the increased privacy interest in cell phones outweigh the marginal difference between the government interest in searching a parolee and a probationer without a warrant.
I'm sorry, you wanted to save some time.
I want to make one last point, and really quickly on the Confrontation Clause violation. The statement that was admitted at trial that Ms. McAlpine made to another officer came through the double hearsay testimony of an officer who did not interview Ms. McAlpine and has actually never made contact with her. This was the only statement in the entire case that directly accused Mr. Johnson of possessing the gun found in 905 Missouri Street. It's exactly the type of testimonial hearsay the Supreme Court held in Crawford violates the Confrontation Clause. And so it was error to allow the government to admit that hearsay that testimonial hearsay for the purported non-hearsay purpose.
Don't we still analyze it, even if there is a constitutional violation, don't we still analyze it under the totality of the circumstances and ask what other evidence existed in order to determine whether it was harmless or
not? Yes, Your Honor. I think in light of the text message and this accusatory statement, it cannot be said that this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Mary Jean Chan, and I represent the United States in this appeal. The only error that the District Court committed in this case was at sentencing by failing to find that California robbery is a crime of violence under the Guidelines Provision, Section 2K2.1. The District Court did not clearly err in finding, after a full evidentiary hearing, that McAlpine validly consented to the search of the Missouri Street apartment, nor did it err in finding that Johnson's parole condition permitted the search of both the residence and his cell phone, and its evidentiary rulings were also correct. Today I'm going to address, unless there are other questions, the three major points, plus the sentencing issue, the three major points that my defense counsel raised. The search of the residence was an appropriate finding. The District Court found two bases independent for upholding the search. First was that McAlpine consented. This was not a clear error in its finding. I know that the defense counsel mentioned some testimony from Officer Wise. I wasn't able to find that in the record, but also, as Judge Tolman mentioned, the entire purpose of having a fact finder decide things is there are hard questions sometimes. The fact finder is there watching the testimony, listening to the testimony. In this case, Judge Anderson listened to Ms. McAlpine. Not only did he actually see her testimony, but also he considered the testimony that she had previously given in state court, jail calls that she had had, and then looked at all the surrounding testimony from seven officers who were at the scene, and made credibility findings in this case that she had validly consented, not only consented, but validly so, that the officers had gone to her with a very pleasant demeanor, and that she had said, sure, go ahead and look for the gun. Or not for the gun, but the
if she was a parole search, would that be a consent here?
I don't think that it would entirely erode. I think it would potentially erode the consent, but the fact is that there are several factors here, and the factors for consent were whether she was in custody, she was not in custody, whether the officers had their guns drawn, they did not, they were very pleasant with her, whether there were Miranda warnings that were given, there were not because none were had to be given, and then whether she basically knew that she had the right to refuse or thought that it was sort of as usual consent. In this case, there was no indication that she thought that this was a parole search. As Judge Tolman mentioned earlier, the officers had arrived responding to a 911 call. There was an emergency. They thought somebody had killed himself or that there was some concern about that. So the entire nature of the call, I think, supports the finding that McAlpine thought that they were there responding to a 911 emergency call and said, go ahead, take a look in the house to clear it, to search for any potential gun. And Officer Wise said that he specifically said, you know, can we go and look to make sure there's nobody that's hurt in there and search for any sort of gun? Because the 911 call was very specific that there was somebody who had killed himself, that Johnson had killed himself with a firearm. And Johnson is the person who, in this case, it's not sort of ridiculous to think that he might have a gun. This is a violent felon, and the officers knew that. The second part of Judge Henderson's finding was that the search was justified under Johnson's parole search condition. And I think that this also was the correct finding. There was, and this court hasn't sort of mentioned any concern about the finding that there was probable cause to believe that Johnson, in fact, resided at the Missouri Street residence. I think the district court in this case was correct in finding that there was probable cause. Johnson himself said, I live here. McCall Blind, his co-resident, said he lives here. And they did this to police officers who knew that, that Johnson was on parole and subject to parole condition. So this has to hold a lot of weight when you think about whether he would lie about this. And there was no reason for the officers to disbelieve him. Why? Because they knew that the address of record in Emeryville was addressed he was not allowed to be at because of the restraining order. Well, they knew that from the record. They did everything. They had consulted the record. And the other thing, Your Honors, is that they found him, honestly, responded to the 911 call saying that he was going to be there. He was there. He came down, said that, and if he wasn't just there sort of in the middle of the day, he was there on a Sunday evening. He came down and said, yes, I live here. So there was really no reason for the officers to believe him, to disbelieve him. There was probable cause to believe him there. Right.
So they knew there was a domestic restraining order barring him from the Emeryville?
I believe so. I believe so, Your Honor. And I would love to be able to sort of check the record just to confirm that. That's my understanding. And certainly the compiled sort of information of the officers in this situation was that they knew that they were doing. That's one of the reasons there were so many officers responding to this. Moving on to this.
To this particular station?
I don't know. There had been a notice, and then the officer said that they hadn't necessarily read the notice. One had known about it, one wasn't sure that he knew about it. But the fact is, Sergeant Jonas, who was part of the same station, had investigated a potential break-in at Crescent Circle in San Francisco. That was Bonnie F.'s house. Bonnie F. was the friend of Nina, who was the person who made the 911 call. Both of them had restraining orders out against Johnson. So there was this break-in or attempted break-in where they believed that Johnson was a suspect here. And so there was kind of a be on the lookout notice for Johnson as a suspect, and it noted that he was dangerous, that he was a violent felon with a history of being connected to murders, attempted murders, domestic violence, assault. That any officers who came into contact with Johnson should take appropriate precautions. I suspect that might be part of it, and certainly the fact that there was a 911 call suggesting that somebody had killed themselves with a firearm would also support that kind of a response, especially since we all know that suicide sometimes can turn into suicide murders, sometimes suicide by blue. So it warrants a lot of caution. With respect to the search of the cell phone, the district court also correctly found that this was supported by Johnson's parole search condition. His parole search condition, the California parole search condition, is pretty absolute in its language and its breadth. It says that the defendant, the parolee, his residence, and any property under his control is subject to suspicionless search. So that really includes the cell phone in this case. And Johnson has not argued that the language, any property under your control, does not include the cell phone. Instead, he's arguing that Sampson, which very absolutely says that a parolee has no legitimate expectation of privacy with respect to those things that are covered by the search condition, is somehow rolled back by Riley. And that's simply not true. This court has never held that, and Riley itself, if you look at the language, doesn't do anything close to that. Riley concerned the search incident to arrest exception to the warrant requirement, an entirely separate requirement. And in that context, the Supreme Court has held that you can't search somebody's home. Generally, in Chadwick, it said that you can't search somebody's home as part of search incident to arrest. You can't even search a container unless it's something that's on them. So the entire exception is basically very, very immediate. It has to happen at the time of arrest. It has to be something that's within the person's reach, because the rationale for the search incident to arrest exception is that the person could be holding something that could proved to be harmful to the officers, so we have officer safety, and that they could immediately destroy some sort of evidence. And the Supreme Court found that those two concerns are not particularly further when you're talking about cell phones. People are not going to generally use cell phones as weapons to hurt a police officer, and there are ways to pretty quickly block a cell phone so that you don't allow for the destruction of evidence. The Laura case dealt with the probation search context, which is different. There is a continuum of search, of punishments.
Of privacy interests.
Of privacy interests. Exactly. So this is really sort of distinct. But even in Laura, what we had were very distinct factors, distinguishable from this case. That case, you have a probationer. In this case, we have a parolee. That case was a probationer that was non-violent. Here, we have a very violent felon. There, we had somebody who wasn't particularly, the only concern was that he might have been violating his probation condition by not showing up to meetings with his probation officer. Here, we have somebody where there's probable cause to believe that he was violating his restraining order against domestic violence and involving domestic violence, that he had ownership and possession of a gun where he was a prior felon with a very violent history. So you have totally different sets of concerns that go on the weight because of the balancing scale. There was a question that was asked earlier about whether there's a different sort of balancing test. There isn't. There's one test, and it's a balancing test. You look at the interests of the defendant's privacy, and you look at the government's interests in making that intrusion. Here you have very, very low expectations of privacy on the part of Mr. Johnson. He's a parolee, which under Sampson says he has a very negligible interest of privacy anymore, in not just his person, but his house. So when we talk about sort of cell phones, yes, cell phones contain a lot of data, but it's comparable to what you have, the privacy interest you have in your house. It isn't higher necessarily. It could be lower, but it's comparable. It's totally different than talking about comparing the data in a cell phone to what might piece of paper in your pocket, which is what Riley was comparing. It's totally
parolee.
I'm saying that from this court, if we look at Laura and we look at the line of probation cases that this court has held, the court has held in terms of expectations of privacy and the government's interests in invading that or intruding upon that, a person who has a violent past or a violent criminal record has fewer expectations of privacy, and the government has a higher interest in searching them and supervising them. So I think that in the parolee context, it really in some ways shouldn't matter at all, because Sampson has made a blanket rule that says that when the search condition covers the search of your person, residence, any property under your control, that's it. Because you're a parolee, there's that's sort of the end of the story. But if we're going to sort of use Laura and those other cases where we're talking about probationer, and that isn't the end of the story, because it isn't just because you're a parolee and it's a blanket condition, then we still, even under that test, we should still be able to affirm, or this court should still affirm, the district court. In terms of exceeding the scope, I think the district court found that it did exceed the consent, the scope of the consent. We don't think that that was the correct ruling, but it's not clearly erroneous as well. However, the fact that he gave some consent further diminished his expectation of privacy. So we have violent parolee suspected of crime, probable cause of crime in the phone itself. We have also the fact that prior to the search, he consented on two occasions to the officers looking at his phone in during this exact time range. And I think it's also important to note that the text that we have here, we're not talking about metadata or some very, very esoteric part of the cell phone. We're talking about messages that the officer saw by manually scrolling through, and it's from and to a number that isn't identified. So it could have been to Nina. It could have been from Nina as far as Sergeant Jonas knew. So we think that the consent certainly weighs in this in this analysis in favor of the district court's finding that there was a justified search. And the delay, I know that my colleague didn't mention it, but it's a very reasonable delay. And if you look at the Sullivan case, I think it makes it clear. The officer got the phone, immediately gave it to the multimedia center. When the multimedia center was able to completely copy it, download it, he looked at it immediately, 3 days. Nicole Pine's statements were not admitted erroneously either. First of all, the standard of review here is plain error because they didn't make the confrontation clause constitutional argument at trial. It was a pure hearsay challenge. But under any standard, the statements were properly admitted. It was very clear the jury was told by the court that it was admitted only for the purpose of showing the course of the police investigation. It was basically the defendant's contention that it was actually to Keith Martin, who was Nicole Pine's daughter's boyfriend, who sometimes lived at the residence or had previously before they broke up, that the gun actually belonged to him, and that the police, this sloppy police work, was the reason why they didn't find him or pursue him, and that really it was to Keith Martin. So prior to the admission of the statement at issue, the defense had already admitted to Keith Martin's rap sheets to try to show that it was him.
How was sloppy police work in defense to possession?
It wasn't effective in the end, but it was
great.
I think they were trying to say that sloppy, if they hadn't been so sloppy, they would have realized that was actually to Keith Martin who owned the gun, and this was completely refuted by the text messages. Exactly. And they asked, Sergeant Jonas was the fifth witness at trial. They had asked about Keith Martin to three of the four witnesses prior to that. They had talked about this at length in their opening, and they had in their limines prior to trial also indicated that they were going to pursue this line of defense. In light of that, the context of this, in light of the fact that there were limiting instructions, that the government didn't even return to this in its closing argument, and that there was overwhelming other evidence, including the fact that he had text saying that he had damaged his PT-92 Taurus gun, and it matched what they found at the location where he and Najee Keith Martin was at, there was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I haven't really addressed much the government's cross-appeal, but I think the case of Chavez-Cuevas makes clear that there was error and it should be remanded. The only thing is that I would ask this court to consider in its order for remand, instructing the district court that on remand it should use under 18 U.S.C. 3742G the guidelines manual in effect on the date of the previous sentencing of the defendant prior to the appeal and not the current guidelines manual, only because that's sort of been a question that has been coming up in other cases, and some of the district courts could use that guidance.
Judge Anderson has now retired, so the sentencing
panel. That could be right. I'm not sure, Your Honor. I think that must be right. If he's retired, then that has to be the case. For Mr. Thompson, perhaps. So we ask for an affirmance on all the other grounds. And thank you for your time.
I'll touch on a few points very briefly, Your Honors. Officer Wise's testimony is in the record, ER 163 to 165, the court's reference. The government made some arguments about how the police didn't have their guns drawn. There wasn't, Ms. McAlpine wasn't in custody. If you look at the cases, United States v. Scheib is a case by this court, Bumper v. North Carolina, it's pretty clear that there doesn't have to be that kind of show of a gun pointed at someone's face for consent to be involuntary.
You're making a clear error argument as to the district court's factual findings with regard to the application.
No, I'm just saying that the legal test doesn't require that there be circumstances where a police has put their hand on a gun or merely acquiescing to an assertion of authority, and it doesn't have to be a gun in the face, is enough to render.
Your argument is a mistake. I her mistake, McCall Pine's mistake, in thinking that this is a parole search is equivalent to coercion and initiating her consent.
Right, caused by Officer Wise's actions.
Do you have a case that says a mistake as opposed to coercion initiates consent?
I think Bumper versus North Carolina and United States versus Shining make that clear. In Bumper, the grandmother of the defendant opened the door and just walked in. The police walked in, and she had no idea if they could do it, had a warrant or not, and the Supreme Court said the consent was involuntary.
Would you testify that she knew that Johnson was subject to a search condition?
She did.
Because he was on parole.
Yeah, that's correct.
And then he had given her address to his parole officer as the location where he was living.
Right, but I think that's...
So, doesn't that fit under kind of your argument that she was somehow coerced on the point? If she thought that the police were going to be a parole search, she had prior warning that it was a condition that would be attached to his parole, and that her address was now at risk of a parole search.
Right, but that parole condition only applies to her home insofar as he actually lived there. And it's our position that he did.
She testified that he was
He was an overnight guest.
Oh, I thought she testified that she let him use her address with his parole officer as where he was living. I thought I read that correctly.
Yes, but I do not think that's a situation whereby providing that address means that she also subjected herself to Johnson's parole search condition.
I guess my question is that you've got a bad fact for your argument, which is the fact that she knew well before 8 or 10 seconds as the police officers arrived at her front door that her home was subject to a parole search because of that.
I think there's a difference between giving the parole officer an address and her actually understanding that, or her affirmatively subjecting her home to Mr. Nose's parole search condition. I think there's a distinction there.
Thanks very much. The case just argued is submitted.